Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rated G Radio. We're going to have just a magical show tonight. We have Hollywood legend Harry Colley, who will be joining us in just a couple of moments. And he's going to talk to us about all kinds of stuff, and I've got lots of questions for him about all the projects that he worked on in the 70s. So many of the shows you'll remember either growing up like I was, or if you were already an adult and enjoying them on primetime, I think you're going to really enjoy tonight's show. But before I bring Harry on, I want to give you a real quick preview of the rest of the week so you can kind of set your calendars to it. Tuesday night, tomorrow night, we have comic John Cooperman. He's going to be my special VIP guest co-host tomorrow night. We're going to be talking about current events, and he'll be giving some of his witty rants and raves about things that are going on in the world. Wednesday, we have Carol Ramsey. She is a new guest to the show, and she is a psychic out of Naples, Florida. So she's going to be calling in and talking to us and taking your listener calls. So make sure to call in early for Carol Ramsey on Wednesday. Thursday, we have a new author. I haven't had a chance to speak to her, but she's hot off the plane from Australia, and her name is Tanya Elizabeth, and Tanya and I are going to get together the following week, but her interview is going to be this coming Thursday, so I'm looking forward to that, and she's, again, direct in from Australia, so we're excited to have her on. And then Friday night, we've got Sasha's Block. If you've not heard of Sasha's Block, you soon will. They are a big band jazz band, and I had the pleasure of going to their album release party last month in Hollywood, and quite spectacular. And we're going to have Alexander, who is the organizer and leader of Sasha's Block, on the line with us on Friday. So we got a great week for you, folks. But without further ado, I want to make sure to welcome Mr. Harry Colley. He is our VIP special guest star tonight. Harry, thanks for coming on to the show. How are you tonight?
I'm very good, thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm glad that you're here, too. And I will tell you, I love people who have been involved in the world of entertainment, and especially from, if I can, I mean it as a compliment, but from a historical perspective, because you've had such a rich and long career in so many things. I have about 500 questions, so it might be that we talk to you a little bit tonight, and then we have you back on another dozen times. But I'd love to talk to you about I'll ask you where you want to start, but I know that you have one career in theater, you got another in TV, and publishing, so you've got it all.
I'll tell you, when my first novel was published, it was about kids in the 40s. It starts in the 40s, and it went up to the Korean War. And somebody in London was interviewing me, and he had read it, and he said, "Do you always write historical novels?" And I thought, my God, that's my childhood. what is he talking about?
What novel?
And you just said historical value. Well, it is historical values at this point. But I couldn't believe that somebody was talking about my childhood, saying, you know, this is an historical novel. So,
Let me ask you, I'll have to go find, is it available on Amazon? Can I go get it as a download or anything like that?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. What's the name of your book?
One of them is Bridey and Finn, the one I was just talking about.
Okay.
Bridie and Finn, Finn.
Finn. I'm going to go get that tonight. Is that I'll have something to read tonight to go to bed. Thank you so much. Okay. So what was that book about? So how did you end up writing this book? And I'm going to back up before.
I got too old to get jobs in television anymore. And I thought, I'm not going to go and ride a golf court and pretend I'm getting exercise. So I thought, I always wanted to write a novel, and I sat down and wrote a novel, and luckily it sold, the first one. It's just sold 100,000 copies in Germany.
Get out of town. Wow. So
isn't that incredible? I mean, quite understand that, because it's a very American story. It's about two kids. It starts in the very beginning of World War II, and it takes them to as they grow up up to the Korean War, as I said. I don't quite know why it's been so popular in Germany. It was also a bestseller in England when it came out. So,
when did you publish this?
This was it was about 15 years ago now. The first publication, yeah.
That is,
but it's still selling in Germany. Thank you,
yeah.
to the German readership. You know, it's wonderful.
To write something in the year 2000 and have it sell 100,000 copies in Germany for an American novel set back in the 40s and 50s, that's quite an achievement.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's one part of the book, during the war, my mom went, she quit teaching school and went to work in an army depot. And there were a lot of young German prisoners of war there and Italian prisoners of war. And these were kids. They had absolutely no idea why they were in the army or what was going on. And my mother felt very sorry for them, and she gave them all little Christmas gifts and stuff. And it's weird to say that about prisoners of war, isn't it? But I think maybe the Germans liked the idea that somebody felt, you know, something for their young people when they were in the war. So I don't know whether that has the appeal. I'm trying to find out. I'll never find out. But it's just I'm delighted that the Germans like it so much.
I'm now fascinated by that. I would really like to figure it, because probably what happened is you probably had somebody who was a big champion, and then they went back and told two friends, and then it just kind of went like wildfire. And did you do any unique press or any interviews for that region?
No, never in Germany. I did a lot in England because it was published in England before it was published here. No, I don't know. It got wonderful reviews in Germany, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. You know, all the reviews were very good. I got all these German reviews sent to me by William Mars, they were my agent at the time, and I had to find a German person to translate all these reviews, which were sensational. So that had a lot to do with them, sure.
I love it. Now, you said that was your first book. What other books have you written, Harry?
I have a novel out called The Botticelli Angel, which is, it's also set, isn't it funny, I'm thinking about this, it's also set back, and it's right before sound came into movies. And believe me, I was not born before sound came into movies, so I'm not, I just want to make that clear.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that book, which was optioned for a movie for about 4 years in a row, and it just didn't happen. That also did well in Europe. It's never been published in this country, but the European edition is available. And also, I think it's on. I'm sure it's on. E-books or whatever they are.
Sure.
And then I have a book about cats. Cats that I've had. Now, and I'm not necessarily a cat person. I am an animal freak. I love animals. I now have two dogs, two very spoiled dogs.
What
one
kind?
Refuses to eat breakfast but likes brunch. So tells you. Tells you how spoiled they are, right?
What kind of dogs do you have, Harry?
I have a little Tibetan Terrier. She's a rescue dog, and then I have a Papillon, which belonged to some friends of mine who shouldn't have gotten dogs because they're always so busy and they don't have time for them, and so he came to live with me, and he's very, very happy here. So, and I'm very happy to have them.
Very good. So, well, I'm a big dog fan myself. So, anytime people start talking about, pets, and I've got five little ones, and they're all rescues. So, I've got five Chihuahuas. Three came from the same litter, and sparing the whole story, I got them the day after I got another rescue, and she was 8 weeks old. I was in Central Arizona meeting a client, and these three dogs, the owners were going to leave these 8-week-old puppies behind, and just hope that whoever came to find the house. And I said, Paul, that's just not going to happen. So I, you know, I picked them up and brought them home. But you know, at the time I was living in Arizona. I had, I think, five labs or four labs at the time, and then I, you know, plus these, you know, five little puppies, just absolutely crazy. So, but you know, I've got five little ones
little
now, and they're great. Yeah, the little
these
ones.
These are the first little dogs I've ever had. I had the golden retrievers.
Yeah.
I had great Dane at one time. So.
So why do you think you went from the big dog to the small?
Pardon?
Why do you think you went from the big dog to the small dog? Because
I was always
a big dog.
I can tell you exactly why I went for the small one. I developed a balance problem, and I went into the feed store here to get some wild bird food. And the vet who had put my last dog down, he's a wonderful man, said to me, did you get any other dog? And I said, no, I'm not going to get another dog. And he said, get another dog. You need another dog. So that afternoon, I got a call from the vet's office, and they said, come down and meet this little dog. And I went down, and there she was, and she was scared to death of everybody. She was very badly treated. She wouldn't take food out of my hand for about 3 months. And now, of course, she's a little angel, really. And I said yes right away. And then when my friends realized they really couldn't keep this Papillon, I said, I'll take him. You know, my father always used to say, I hope nobody comes to your door with an elephant. Because I would say yes.
You're probably both lucky to have each other.
Flies or swims. Pardon?
And I said, well, they're lucky to have you, and you're lucky to have them. So it's
Yes. We're very happy together. Yes. I'm so glad to hear you have rescued dogs. That's wonderful.
They're just the best. Really, you know, and I don't care if you get them at, you know, 8 weeks or if you get them. Well, one of my little ones, I got him when he was five or four. And, you know, he just had a terrible life, you know, before being rescued by my vet. I certainly didn't need another dog, but my vet put him in their little monthly newsletter and, you know, emailed it out. And I saw that, and, I looked down at the dog, and I'm going, you know, I must be smoking something I shouldn't be smoking. Because I'm calling the vet saying, you know, what's the dog's problem? Because I don't need another dog, but why do you put this animal's picture in here? And they said, well, just come down and, you know, take a look at him. And, you know, so the rest, of course, is history. But, and, you know, and he was an older dog, you know, four and a half years old when I got him, Harry. And I'll tell you, best little champion ever. And, you know, he's even got his own Facebook fan page now. So, I mean, there you go.
Well, you're now 10 feet tall.
Yeah, well,
so there you go. Absolutely.
Well, let's get back to your career, because otherwise I'm going to talk for an hour about the fact that we're both pet lovers
I'll
here.
I'll never shut up once I start talking about the dogs.
I need to also give some props real quick out to Robert Michael Morris, who connected us. Michael is just a fantastic actor in his own right and a published author and just a real good friend. And so I want to make sure that I give him some kudos tonight, Harry, for making sure we got connected.
Absolutely. Yeah. He worked at my summer theater when I had a summer theater, and we've been friends ever since, and that was many years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
where should we go? Do you want to talk about your career in theater, or do you want to talk about TV or other publishing that you've got going on?
Okay.
I mean, we've got so much. It's throw a dart.
I just, I will start with, I'll just tell you that I was born in Princeton, New Jersey, which was a totally idyllic town, perfectly beautiful. And that town had a theater. It was connected to the university. When I was about 15 years old, 15, 16, it was rented as a summer theater to producers to be used as a summer theater. And it's a gorgeous theater. At one time, it was a roadhouse. You know, shows tried out there before they went to New York. As a matter of fact, the very first production ever of Our Town was at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton.
Really?
Before it went to New York. Yeah, before it went to New York. So I knew an actress who was where she was a little, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years older than me, but I knew her family, and I said, you're so lucky to be down there working, and she was working as an ingenue there, and she said, well, come on down, and I went down, and that was it, of course. You know, I got $10 a week, and that was to clean the men's room and the ladies' room in the theater.
Okay.
You'd get nothing else, and I worked my butt off. I mean, truly. But I loved every second of it, and it was a star system. I mean, we had Tallulah Bankhead come through.
Get out.
No, and she was so outrageous and so wonderful, and I have a couple Bankhead stories, so I'll tell you those.
Oh, I would love to hear them.
One of them is, well, I think it's alleged that she was the first one who ever said, who do you have to fuck to get a drink around here?
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it sure sounds like her because she was so outspoken. She was so outrageous and wonderful. And I do have one story that I was standing right next to her when she said it. There was a woman who worked backstage. Her name was Irene. And she was considerably older than me. I mean, a lot older than me, probably twice as old as me. And I don't know whether she was doing it to get college credit or I have no idea. But anyway, she had a little cocktail apron that she was having all the stars sign, and then she was going to embroider them. And she happened to come to Tallulah to ask her to sign it while Tallulah was signing autographs for two little old ladies who were standing there, who had come backstage to see her and ask for her autograph. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tallulah called everybody darling because she couldn't remember anybody's name. And, yeah, true, that really is the reason. She would say, oh, darling, darling. And she had, you know, that voice, it was deep, much deeper than mine. She always had a cigarette in her hand. She was just a marvelous character. Well, Irene happened to come over and say to Tallulah, would you sign this because I'm going to autograph it and, you know, I'm going to rather embroider it. And she said, well, of course, darling. Where do you want me to sign it? Right across the twat? And these, yes, yes. And these two little ladies just giggled. They had absolutely no idea what she was talking about. And they just thought it was so cute that you, and that, yeah, she was wonderfully outrageous. Well, there's a great story. She had a radio show. It was called The Big Show. And there was a gay electrician on it. And he left a cable that she tripped over. And she turned to him and said, listen, darling, maybe you fairies can fly, but Mama has to walk. And I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yeah, I love
what
her.
What a great time. I mean, for your first, you know, job in the theater, I mean, you couldn't buy your way in for something
like that. First job
in
the theater. Tallulah Bankhead, Gloria Swanson, Charlton Heston, the most boring man that ever lived.
Really?
Oh, God. Well, he did a boring play. He did Kafka's The Trial in a summer theater. Hello. In a summer theater, you know, please. He did it with his wife, Lydia Clark, I think her name was. Let me see who else was there. John Forsythe.
Wow.
Also boring.
Really?
Yeah, boring. Very boring man. We had Carol Burnett. Carol's coming up. I'm going to tell you some stories because I worked with
Carol. Oh, I can't wait.
No, but there were there was just a whole list of people. Larry Parks, who had done the Jolson story, and he was destroyed by Joe McCarthy, you know,
so many activities. Were. Yeah,
well,
oh, man.
He ended up dying in his garden of a heart attack after it. His career was nipped and he was very young. It was the most wonderful, wonderful way to start a life in the theater.
Years were you able to be part of that theater?
Well, it was only there 2 seasons.
And you met all of those people in 2 seasons?
2 seasons. And
wow.
Oh, yeah. I met all those people in 1 season, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well, every week there was a new play.
Oh, there you go. Well, that would do
in
it.
The
yeah,
old
sure.
Days, in the old days, that's what we did. When I had my theater, we did, the first couple of years, we did a play a week, a full play a week. And then eventually, then when the theater was started to do pretty well, we could go to, you know, 2 weeks, to have a show go 2 weeks. And that was because then we had a couple of days off, you know.
So what's involved when you do a play a week? How many days is rehearsal, and then when do you do shows on, like, Friday, Saturday, or what was the schedule
like?
Well,
you do two shows on Saturday and two shows on Wednesday, a matinee and an evening performance. You generally had Sunday off.
Okay.
While you were performing at night, you were learning a new play during the day. And rehearsing.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And you never got them confused.
I don't know
you
how that's possible.
Got them
confused. I would be calling not only everybody darling, but every line I would recite would be darling. Oh my word!
Yeah, I know. No, it was wonderful though. It was really great. It was a great discipline for actors, and it's too bad that summer theaters have sort of disappeared. There are still some around. And, the dinner theater, there once was, you know, a time when actors could really support themselves in summer theaters. I did it. I certainly did summer theaters, and I did dinner theater tours as an actor, and I did all right. From my 30s on, from like 32 or 33, I never had to take another job. I supported myself in the business.
I love to hear that. So
it's wonderful, isn't it?
What was your first role in the theater outside of helping maintain the cleanliness of restrooms?
Well, in that summer, I got a part. And Nancy Walker was there. She had been a star on Broadway and worked a lot. And she was doing the lead in Anything Goes. And there was a scene where she gets thrown into it. It's a wonderful musical with all that wonderful Cole Porter music. But there's a scene where she's thrown into jail on the ship for some reason. And with these Chinese converts. And she plays strip poker with them, and she gets the costume, and that's how she gets out of jail. It's absolutely, utterly ridiculous, but still wonderful froth. It's just wonderful.
Sure.
I was cast. Now, I was 6'2 and a half. I probably weighed 125 pounds. The skinniest
thing
alive.
Oh, my gosh, you were thick.
Yeah, I was. And I got cast as one of these Chinese converts.
Well, that makes perfect sense at 6'2".
Absolutely. It was perfect.
Oh, my gosh.
Great fun. And then the next job I got that same summer was in a play with a man named Sonny Tufts. Now, I know it sounds like a funny name, but he was a sweet guy. And he was unfortunately, he drank too much, and he had to have his lines. He had his lines on tabletops and on the mantelpiece, and he would walk over and read his lines because he forgot them all.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, in that one, I played an Eskimo.
As one would.
Yes. That's what you did when you were an apprentice in these little theaters. That was a huge theater. But that's what you did. You got to play those parts that they didn't want to hire anybody for them.
As this, you know, kind of up-and-comer that has this theater bug bite him in his first summer in theater there, do they recognize that, boy, I really want to do this, and, boy, that Harry's a go-getter, so let's cast him as the Eskimo or cast him as this or cast him as that just because we need to fill the part, and he's a warm body and he's already cleaning the restroom, so we'll, you know, go ahead and throw him into the play.
Yeah, that's exactly why I got the
play.
Wow. But that's the only reason I got them, because I was there and I was doing props and, you know, returning furniture and picking up furniture. That's what I did most of the time. But I loved the fact that I was standing in the wings every night
watching these
wonderful, wonderful actors.
What a great treat.
Pardon?
What a great treat.
Oh, yeah. It was incredible. Do you remember Ruth Gordon?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, yes. You know, from Rosemary's Baby and...
Yeah.
Yes, well... She was doing a play that she wrote there. It was called Over 21. Tiny, tiny little woman. She always wore spike heels and had her hair in an up sweep so that she looked taller.
Mm-hmm.
And I adored her. I just loved her. She was from New York, and she talked like that. And she was just great. And one day, standing in the wings, she said to me, because I was like a puppy dog. Truly, I followed her around. I loved her so much. And she said, "Listen, kid, I'm going to give you the best piece of advice you ever had. Don't quit. Don't give up. Everybody gives up. What's the matter with them? Don't quit." And I swear, her voice is echoed in my mind, you know, for years and years and years. And
wow.
Times when I thought, I'm going to quit and I'm going to get out of here, you know. I never did.
But you stuck with it. So how long did you decide that you wanted to be a performer, and when did that transition into doing writing and some producing and other things for you?
Well, I always wrote. When I was in the Army, I wrote a musical that toured. I came up with the idea, actually, for the musical. It was the first science fiction musical. It may have been the only one. I don't know if there have been any science fiction musical.
And what was it about?
It was about, you know, somebody who got in a rocket ship and went to Mars, and he fell in love with this Martian girl. It was utterly ridiculous and great fun. And we toured in Germany and England. Yeah. Yeah, it was wonderful. Buck Henry wrote the book for it. He was then Buck Zuckerman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Buck Henry. And
wow.
And a fellow named Kay Dunkley did the music, and I wrote the lyrics for it. It was wonderful. I mean, we got to tootle around. Oh, and they hired the women from England. They went to England and auditioned English girls, and then they brought them over, and they toured with us in the show, and we did it for damn near a year, I guess.
Wow!
So, yeah.
What a great experience for you! Just right out of the gate, you know, you have your theater experience back home, and you just take that on the road with you when you're in the military. How fantastic is that? So, what did you do in the service?
Well, when I first went in, they stuck me in the medical corps. This was during the very end of the Korean conflict. Isn't that funny that we still say the Korean conflict? It was a war. It was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, not just a conflict. I finished college, and then I was drafted, and I went in, and they put me in the medical corps, and I went to Germany as a dental assistant. Thank you very much.
Mm.
Well, I got over there and I did it. And there were two dentists in Crailsheim, Germany, little tiny, tiny town with an American Army post. And there were two dentists. One was a colonel who worked on people with a cigar in his mouth with ashes falling off.
Ugh.
Yeah, is that enough to make you sick to your stomach? And the other was a German dentist who was, I think, was truly a Nazi. I don't think he ever got over that. Yeah, he was not pleasant. So I thought, no, I don't like this very much.
Mm-hmm.
And the service club on the base was going to do a show, and they said that they were looking for people to do things. So I did a dance number in it with one of the service club hostesses. And it everybody liked it a lot. And so I went to my captain and I said, I would like to go up to 7th Army headquarters and audition for special services. And he said, well, you can do that, but I'm not going to let you go. And I said, well, I would like to do it. And they had to let you do it.
Oh.
They had to let you go and do it. So, so I went up. And we did this dance to Frank Sinatra's record of Bim Bam Baby. It was a jazz thing.
Oh,
and we
wow.
put it in the back of the We put it in the back of her little Volkswagen, and she drove me up. She was a great gal. And we went in to audition, and we went back to get the record, and the sun had melted it.
No!
It was all rippled, and oh, it was terrible. But the same records were given to, you know, all of the service clubs. So we went, and we found it, and we did it. And the fellow who, I was trying to think of his name, the fellow who auditioned us had been on Broadway in a couple musicals. And I said to him, my captain said that he was not going to let me go. And he said, oh, screw him, you know. And he said, I'll make it come down as a general order.
Uh-huh.
And that's exactly what happened. That night,
wow.
I went back the very next morning. I got on the train and left Crailsheim and went to Stuttgart to Hitler's. We'd stayed in Hitler's stormtrooper barracks.
Really?
Gosh. Yeah. Yeah, they were spectacular. They were wonderful. And the 7th Army Symphony was there. The basketball team, the football team, they were there. And then the Variety Club and the Variety artists, I always love that. And I was in that group. So that was it. Then I stayed there until the night before I came back from Germany. And that's when they had to send me back to my unit. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew who I was.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Well, you know, all the
they all changed,
had
yeah.
Gone by. Yeah. And then I got on a boat and came home, and that was it. So, but I had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time.
That is, you know, it's so interesting that you'd spend your time in the military over in Germany when, you know, the quote-unquote Korean conflict, you would have you half a world away.
Well, that had ended just when I finished basic training.
Oh, okay. Well, thank goodness for that. So they needed to stick you someplace.
Yeah. So off I went to Germany, which I loved, of course, being in Europe. Can you imagine? And then,
oh, my gosh.
And then our show went over to England, and we had like 5 or 6 days in England, and I went to – I saw Julie Andrews when she was 19 years old and the boyfriend.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was wonderful, wonderful. I went one day. They used to be able to, they used to have a supper show at some theaters, a supper show, an evening show, and a matinee. 3 shows in one day. And I
Holy
remember
cow.
Going to 3 different theaters to 3 shows in one day.
That must have been fun.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was really wonderful.
So when your touring show ended after that year, what did you do next?
Then I came back, and I couldn't wait to get to New York, to live in New York, of course. And I
forgot to ask you, where did you grow up?
In New Jersey.
That's right. So you just crossed the bridge,
yeah.
Kind of, and went over and hung out.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I was a little kid, like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, I went to a Catholic school, and we had December 8th off. It was the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And they had already mounted the Christmas show in New York. So my mom took me to New York every December 8th to go to the Christmas show at Radio City Musical. And
so did that kind of help?
There were the Rockettes, and I did not want to be a Rockette. But, you know.
Probably the glamour of show business, though.
Oh, it was spectacular to me. Just spectacular. Mm. So when
Isn't
I got out of
fantastic?
The Army, I went to New York, and I went to the American Theater Wing. I went nights, and I worked in the Doubleday bookshops during the day, $40 a week for 40 hours. And you lived
wow.
on it.
Yeah.
You lived on it.
What kind of a lived on it were you able to do? What was, like, rent, and did you have to share
well,
it with
my
folks?
First,
or?
Get this. My first rent in New York, this was in 1953. My first rent in New York was $26 a month for a cold water flat. There was no heat.
Wow.
But you you lit your stove, and then, you know, in the kitchen. And it was a tiny little kitchen and a tiny little everything, because it was a very small flat. But that that's how you heated up the apartment, you know. It was wonderful. I thought I was living in a palace.
Wow.
I was in New York, going to the theater wing and working in Doubleday bookshops. I mean, come on. Now I'll get to a famous person in the Doubleday bookshops.
Oh,
I worked in Grand Central Station primarily. But if somebody was short in one of the other shops, they would occasionally send us over there. So I went to, this is going to really freak you out. I went to 56th Street and 5th Avenue, and was a huge shop, and was standing in there. And I'm waiting for customers to come in, and I look over, and in comes this woman, all in black. And it was Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, my gosh.
I almost killed everybody, every other sales clerk, to get to her first. Really, unbelievable. Yeah, Marilyn Monroe. No makeup on. She was going to the actor's studio at the time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, she was and very sweet and very nice and very beautiful. Without a
Do you remember what she bought?
Any makeup. Yeah. Pardon?
Do you remember what she bought?
No, I don't. But she came back again another time, not too long after that. And she looked for me because we talked and we got along very well. And she had a list. This is amazing. She had a list of books that she wanted that were suggested to her by Carl Sandburg.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The great American, he was the great biographer of Lincoln. And we had some of them. They were classics, and, you know, they were usual stock, but some had to be ordered. But and she chatted, and she was just, oh, gosh, she was a nice lady. Anyway, when she left with the few books that we did have, here was the list on the counter in Marilyn Monroe's handwriting, suggested by Carl Sandburg. I crinkled it up and threw it in the garbage. Can you imagine what an idiot I was?
Well, you probably weren't thinking, okay, this is going to be worth something someday.
Not thinking one bit. I mean, I was so thrilled that I had just waited on her anyway. But, when I think of that a million times now. Do you know what that would be worth? In Marilyn Monroe's handwriting.
It'd just be crazy.
Yeah. But she was lovely. But it was a great place to work. I saw Greta Garbo there, waited on her, actually. Tall lady with giant feet. She had big, big feet, I remember. She
really?
Had feet. Yeah. She was also very beautiful.
And you wouldn't think of Greta Garbo as being a tall lady either.
No, she was tall. Tyrone Power, waited on him. Not bad. Not bad at all. So good looking. He was just, it was freaky. He was so good looking, you know. Anyway, but I loved working in the bookstores, except you didn't make any money, but that didn't matter.
Listen, well, you know, you had your palatial flat. You were in New York. You were seeing plays. You know, I mean, I like your perspective on that, though.
And I went to the theater, standing room only, $2.50. I saw Yul Brynner and Gertrude Lawrence and King and I.
Oh,
I mean, it was just a magical time to be there. A magical time to be there. Well, I guess, you know, today young kids are saying, God, it's wonderful to be here in New York. By the way, New York is no longer, the theater is no longer just for kids. King and I is about to open at Lincoln Center, and a friend of mine called me today, and she saw a preview, and said it is absolutely brilliant. It's just wonderful.
Well, I think when you take something that's, you know, such a classic and or, you know, stay true to it, but, you know, maybe give it a little freshen up, I think that's a great thing to do. You know, Harry, I'll tell you, the one thing that just is really kind of shocking to me, and I guess they can do it because they can do it, but the prices for tickets are just crazy today. So, it's, you know, you've got to kind of be, you know, saving up your pennies throughout the year in order to, you know, make that happen.
Absolutely.
But the shows are so spectacular, though. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. She, this friend, she calls herself a theater whore because she'll go see anything. she does see everything. She's a terrific, terrific lady, a very good actress who was, you know, at my summer theater for a couple seasons, and she was terrific. Her name is Sandra Drew, and anyway, she just also saw An American in Paris. The first Broadway version of An American in Paris. And she said it's wonderful. And it did finally get reviewed and wonderful, brilliant reviews. So it's a huge hit. And it's nice because, you know, the theater was getting to... I don't have anything against Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and all those almost kiddie shows. But Broadway used to be for adults. You
right,
know? And it's nice to see that it's getting back to that. So.
Well, I think the parents are going like, well, we're not going to pay $200 to take little Junior to the theater. So, you know, let's go watch an adult show, and we'll just go, you know, for me and my spouse.
Exactly.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, let's get back to you here and things that you were doing. So, where is your evolution taking you after going to theater and watching Bill Brenner for $2.50 and The King and I? That I'm just like, I love, Harry.
I know. It was wonderful. Well, what happened when I came to Hollywood because I read for a play in New York, and it was Travesties by Tom Stoppard. And it was a hit, and it was the British cast. And in those days, except for the star, the supporting cast had to be recast after 3 months with American actors. That was the rule.
Well, whose rule was that?
Equity. Actors Union. Yeah. And I read for the part of James Joyce in it, and with an Irish accent and everything. And when I finished my reading, there was a silence. There were people sitting out in the dark of the theater, and I didn't know who they were. And they finally said, "Can you wait in the green room, please?" And I said yes, and I walked off stage, and there was one of the most energetic, lovely guys. It was the stage manager, and he said, "Oh my God, you got it! Oh my God, you got it!" You know, he was so thrilled. So I went down and I sat there in the green room waiting, and I thought, "No, I didn't get it. That's impossible." So they asked me to come back up and read again, and I went up and I read again, and then I went back down to the green room, and I went back up and read again, and they said, "Thank you very much. We'll let your agent know." Well, by the time I got home, my agent called and said, "You got the part." Okay.
Really?
This was a huge, huge, huge part. The next morning, John Woods, who was the star, had vocal nodes, and they canceled the show. It closed. So I thought, this is it. I'm out of here. I'm going out to California. So really, can you imagine getting that close? You know, I had already spent the money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah. So I came out here and instantly went broke. I didn't have that kind of money with me. But I saw that the executive producer of Maud was a man who had directed me in a public service announcement. It was for black people to be aware of high blood pressure, because they apparently had more high blood pressure than most other ethnic groups. And so he directed me in that. So I called him, and I said I had an idea for a mod. And he said, well, come on up to my office. And I went up, and I talked to him. I noticed his name is Charlie Houck, and I noticed he's still working, which is really wonderful. Anyway, he said, well, he said it's a very funny idea, but we really have all of our shows for this year, for this season. And by the time I got home, my phone rang, and he said, Norman Lear wants you to come in and see him. Because Charlie had gone and told Norman what my idea was. So I went in and I met Norman, and he said, okay, we're going to do your show, and we'll cancel one of the others for this season. And I was thrilled, of course. And I had no idea what it was like to be to write a script and give it to somebody and then have it totally rewritten by their staff. I think totally rewritten. And I didn't receive that script until the day of the shooting, and I was invited to the shooting, and I opened it, and I kept looking for my stuff. There was one line. There was one line of mine, but it said, written by Harry Cawley.
Wow.
That's what it said on the screen. Anyway, so... I went and, I can't think of his name now. Wonderful actor. He played the doctor who lived next door to Maude.
Conrad Bain?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, you're good. You're really good.
I love Maude. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was a good show. Anyway, a friend of mine had told him that I was coming to the show, and he said, oh, God, it's the poor guy. So I went back to meet him, and he had champagne for me. And it was really very nice, and because I had never met him. And then a week later, I got a call from my agent at William Morris, and he said, Norman wants to know if you want to do Mary Hartman. Well... Of course I did. You know, it was.
Was it as hot as it? Was it like the number one show at the time? Because that was.
It
you know,
was
such
damn
a...
close to it.
Yeah.
It yeah. Was very
okay.
close to it. And then they told me what they offered, which was not a lot of money, and I said no. Talk about balls! You know?
Wow.
I mean, really, I said no. That's not enough, and I was dead broke. I did not have two nickels to rub together. And next thing I know, they came back and they doubled it.
Holy cow!
Yeah. Yeah, doubled it. And I went to work for... And I worked for Norman then for about 3.5 years.
Well, it's a good thing you held out.
Shows. I can't believe I did that, you know? I mean, really, that was...
Sometimes it's
a good thing I did.
Yeah, you need to let them know, the value of your worth. And sometimes the best way to do that is just to take a stand. If I could go back 30 years and tell you, I'm proud of you for doing that, because that does take a lot of guts. So can I ask you this? Because, you have this experience in, writing musicals and doing, the acting on Broadway and the theater. How did you get to a point where you said, you know what, I'm going to write a TV sitcom? And, you write this episode for Maude.
Well, I never created a TV sitcom.
Right.
I just got jobs on them. I did Angie.
Angie.
Yeah, I did. I love the cast. I mean, Robert Hayes is a really class act, and... And Donna Pascal is just about as sweet as you can get. She's a wonderful gal. And everybody in the cast was terrific. So, and Doris Roberts. But I knew Doris from New York. Yeah, I knew Doris from New York. So I had already knew her. I was just ready to... I was ready to make some money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I had been... I had been knocking around for a lot of years. I'm keeping myself alive, but I wanted to make some money, and I was in my mid 30s by then, or no, between my mid, probably my mid 30s. Anyway, and I just thought, you know, I'll be happy to get any job anybody offers me in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky to get jobs with people that I really liked and had a very good time doing it.
What was the system like back then?
Pardon?
What was the system like back then to get these jobs?
You didn't get money. You didn't get as much money, number one, in those days as they get now.
Sure.
You didn't get deals like, you know, a young producer now, because I ended up producing several shows. But they all, in order to say, yes, I'll take this deal, you get a deal to write a couple pilots and all that kind of stuff. But that didn't happen. You worked for the studio, and the studio assigned you to a show.
Okay.
And that was pretty much what it was. But it was okay. It was a very good system.
It was fine.
So when we were doing it, I remember when we were doing Angie, Robin Williams was doing Mork in a couple buildings away from us. And he used to come all the time because Mork was his first acting job, really. He was primarily a stand-up comic, you know. And he used to stand in the shadows watching. And I said, come on, you know, have a chair down here. He said, no. I just want, because people already knew him. And I mean, they loved him because he, because of Mark and Mindy. No, he wouldn't do it. He would just stand there. And he said one day, no, I'm just learning. I'm just learning. So.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember thinking that day, I said, my God, here I am, this kid from Charlton Street, who is talking to television stars, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. It was very good. I was a lucky guy.
So what was your writing experience like on Mary Hartman? Because, you were on there for quite some time.
Oh, a couple years. Yeah, I'll tell you what it was like. We all met in Norman's office. Norman had this spectacular office, and then it's this huge table. And the writing staff met. And now, don't forget, we did a show every night. That was not just once a week. We did a
show
every
single night. You were
5 nights a week? Pardon?
You were 5 nights a week?
5 nights a week. We were on 5 nights
Holy
a week, half
cow.
Hour. Yep. So you can imagine how many scripts had to be done. And this is the other thing. This was before computers.
Right.
So
yes, you're on typewriters.
Sitting out in front of us.
Oh, man.
Just outside of our door while we were having our meetings were typists. And we would rewrite pages. And you'd bring them out and hand them to the typist. And they'd run off and they'd do it on a different color page. So that you could insert them into the scripts and, you know what was going on. It was incredible. It was quite incredible and very fast. But you would sit in the this around this big table and throw out ideas and talk. And I'll just tell you two things about doing Mary Hartman that I loved. One of them was Deborah Lee Scott, who played Mary's sister, had an illegitimate child by a priest, and which was hilarious. Everything was outrageous and funny and great. So, but we didn't want to write for a baby or have to worry about a baby being in everything because it was too much of a consideration. So somebody said, what if accidentally Deborah Lee throws the baby in the dryer with her laundry and bumps it to death? I said, no. I was laughing, but it was too disgusting for me. I said, no, we cannot do that. So what we finally did was we had a gypsy steal Deborah Lee's laundry, and in the laundry was the baby.
Oh my gosh.
How we got rid of the baby.
Oh, my goodness. That's hysterical, though.
Can you imagine a bumping a baby to death?
Well, you know, if you guys would have done that, I mean, the you would have been shut down in a heartbeat. Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
Terrible. And
well,
then there was there was another character that had to leave the show because of a drinking problem, and Norman put him in a place to dry out. Norman was wonderful about that. I have to. And Norman was great about everything. But then when he was okay and we wanted to bring him back, I said, "What if he comes back as a Hare Krishna?"
Oh my God!
And everybody laughed, and we all thought it was great fun. And I said this because a friend of mine, that friend that I was talking about, who calls herself a theater whore,
yes.
When I told her on the phone that we had to figure out a way to get him back, she said, "Have him come back as a Hare Krishna." Okay. So they all loved it. And she went to a Christmas party. And I said to her, "You have to watch Mary Hartman tonight, because there's a surprise for you." And she thought the surprise was going to be me being in the show.
Ah.
And she went to a party, and it turned out she went to a Buddhist party. And and said, "I have to watch television." That's what it was. He shows up as a Hare Krishna. Okay. So the Monday following that, we're sitting in Norman's office, and we hear jingle, jingle, jingle bells coming down the hallway. It was the Hare Krishna coming with their lawyer to sue us. I swear to God.
Oh, my gosh.
So we ended up having to have a Hare Krishna on stage to make sure that everything was, you know, kosher.
Oh, my goodness.
And what
that
happened was...
That is crazy.
That's hilarious, yeah. Hilarious. And all the time he was a Hare Krishna, he was smoking and drinking and making out with all the girls in the show. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, well.
Harry, anyway. I'm telling you. You know what? I hate to do this to you, but we're out of time for tonight.
I know. I just saw that. I just looked at my watch. You can't shut me up. You cannot shut me up.
Well, I'm going to tell you, it pleases me to no end to have had you as a guest tonight, but it makes me even happier to say I can't wait to have you back on a future episode and just continue the conversation. I am just so in love with your stories and everything that you're talking about tonight.
We have all those people we haven't even touched on. So.
Oh, I know. We haven't even scratched the surface. And like you said, all the other things. So I'll get with you offline, and we'll figure out a date to bring you back. It's probably going to be May or June, or late May or June at this point. But we'll find a date that works for you and do it. But that will be great. So, Harry, I'm going to say thank you very much for being on tonight. And everybody, if you want to hear a complete replay of the show.
It was great fun, and you were terrific.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you, Harry. You have a good night, and I'll talk to you later.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. And so everybody on West Star Radio Network in the United Kingdom, thank you for spending your drive time home with us tonight listening to Rated G Radio. My hats are off to you for listening to the show. Hope you love it. And we'll tell you that if you would like to have a request for a guest or a musical guest or even a song, make sure to like the Rated G Radio fan page on Facebook, or you can simply email me at garrett@garrettmiller.com. Of course, everybody here stateside, you can follow the show on Blog Talk Radio. You can download as a podcast on Apple's iTunes and all of the cool stuff there. Wow, what a fun guest Harry is. And again, to Robert Michael Morris, our mutual friend, for connecting us, I want to send out big hugs to you and thanks for the fantastic introduction. Everybody else, we're going to see you live on Tuesday with funny man John Cooperman. Tune in tomorrow night on Tuesday, and we will see you live. Don't drive distracted, and have a great night. Take care.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.